My name is Deb Harsma. I'm moderating this session, and thanks for coming out and finding your way over here. Our first speaker is Vlad Pasarin. He is an industrial physicist and is going to tell us about nickel batteries and the MOND process.
Thank you, Deb. So I'll talk about the idea of revisiting this very old process, MOND process, also known as carbonyl refining, as possibly the most creation care method of processing, especially nickel. But the same chemistry works for iron, and I will talk about that. I had the word godly in place of creation care, and I mean the two terms are interchangeable. So that's really the idea. How do we as Christians and scientists and engineers judge processes from their godliness or creation care worthiness perspective? So I will talk about how do you get nickel from the ground or a rock where you have maybe 1-2% of nickel all the way to an electric car, for example, in a lithium-ion battery. And the process that I will be talking about mainly involves this unique molecule, nickel tetracarbonyl, NiCO4, and that's what it looks like. Some of this work is currently underway at the University of Waterloo, and that's my little consulting company that I operate under these days. So I'll talk a little bit about myself, and I'll touch on the subject of 3D printing. You are wondering what's the connection, but I'll spend probably 30% of the talk on that topic, and then the second half on the vapor metallurgy or MOND process. So vapor metallurgy is the other term that is not very popular, but it would be in parallel with terms like hydrometallurgy and pyrometallurgy. So I was born in Czechoslovakia. I started my university studies at Slovak Technical University. And then after the second year, I emigrated to Canada, continued in physics, and I finally got my PhD at the age of 47, so something like 11 years ago. That was in 82 when I came here. That's the title of my thesis. So it was actually on nickel carbonyl. I was fortunate enough to be able to do it part-time while I was working. And I spent 26 years working for INCO, International Nickel Company, currently Vale Canada. It's the Brazilian mining company that acquired INCO in 2006. And then I spent 3 years, so 26 years there, 3 years at Rio Tinto on ferrous powder metallurgy. And in 2018, I came to University of Waterloo to sort of finish off my career in academia. And also in this same year, I founded this little consulting company. That's what we are running currently. It turned into a bit of a family business, and I'll tell you a little bit about that, that involves 3D printing services. How did I get in touch with CSCA or ASA? It was David Humphreys, a professor of chemistry from McMaster University, who introduced me to CSCA. He used to come to our church and give sermons on Sunday morning, performing chemistry experiments as part of his sermon. So he told me about ASA. I then attended the 2014 Canadian meeting in Hamilton and fell in love with the group. I consider this to be my tribe at this point. I call the two organizations the best kept secret of North American evangelicalism or faith science dialogue. So this is the beginnings of my little stint at University of Waterloo. I was managing a 3D printing research group at Mechanical Engineering Department. That's the group as of 2019. I was there for a couple of years, and it's actually the largest academic research group in 3D printing in Canada at the moment. One thing about this is their focus is metal 3D printing. And they managed to attract all kinds of funding, so they have all these fancy, expensive laser-based 3D printers, each one costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one idea that I'm sort of occupying myself with, how could you do metal 3D printing with something a lot more accessible to normal people with low-cost printers, perhaps the ones that many of us have in our basements, the FDM filament-based printers. I'll talk about that briefly. So this is our little family-based business. My two daughters and my wife, who is right there, she just came in. But it's mostly consulting, but we also run this 3D printing service. We have something like 20 printers, the FDM printers, the low-cost printers. And the two daughters are designing parts and people are ordering different things. And most recently, we started selling the printers themselves, which turned out to be an interesting activity. So here is the question. What in our professional lives is God-expired? God-inspired? The Bible is believed to have been inspired by God. What about other great writings and discoveries of science? Have these been inspired by God? And how about our current and future scientific and engineering work? How do we discern God's inspiration in new processes, technical solutions, and advances? For example, is EV more godly than gasoline-powered cars? How can we tell? I was originally planning to give this talk last year, so some of these slides were prepared last year. And last summer, if you read the press, you would see pictures like this with the Chrysler minivans, you know, some of them catching fire. So one might ask, you know, what is so attractive about the technology that causes your house to go on fire in a parking lot? But then I guess the graph I did not show is the environmental impact of the electric cars is undisputably, you know, desirable. And it's an advance compared to combustion engine. In case of 3D printing, so the question is, can we think of a more environmentally acceptable and maybe accessible way of printing with metals? And the hypothesis is that the FDM, or the filament-based printers, are actually capable of printing with metal. You need to play some tricks with them. Like getting the metal particles into the filament, and that's what's being done. It's really not, it's already proven and demonstrated. It's not widely spread. But basically you have the filament that has the metal particles embedded inside. And then when you do, you have to do you have to do a thermal treatment of your print afterwards to burn off the polymer and sinter the metal particles. And you can preserve the 3D shape. You get some shrinkage, but that's one way to print with metal on your home-based printer, as long as you have a place where you can send it, or eventually perhaps these heat treatment facilities may not be so complicated down the road. So that's the FDM printers. You're all familiar with them. This is a picture from Prusa, one of the manufacturers in Czech Republic. This is very close to downtown Prague, the so-called printer farm. Printers printing themselves. If you buy a Prusa printer, all the non-metallic portions of the printer are actually printed by the same printer over in Czech Republic. That's an example of a 50% iron in a filament that can be printed. This is the green part before sintering, but we show that we can preserve that shape. So the metal printing can be one of the end uses of, for example, nickel or iron. So, and I'm arguing that the final use of these metals is one of the criteria we could consider as, you know, is this a godly activity, or is this a creation care sensitive. So I'll talk a little bit about where does nickel come from these days. There are two main types of ores, laterites and sulfides. The laterite ores are usually surface ores or very close to surface, mostly in tropical countries. So you can see all the yellow squares here is laterites. The red dots are sulfides, usually deep underground. So there are different implications of the mining practice and consequences. It just so happens that about 60 or probably close to 70% of all the nickel today comes from laterites. And it's understood that this is the future main source of nickel in the future. And that's what a laterite mine looks like in Indonesia these days. So you can see a significant impact on the environment. Indonesia is very interesting in this because about 60% of all the nickel comes from Indonesia today. So that's the operating capacity of about 2,000 tons per year just coming from Indonesia. The rest of the world is a little bit less than that. And you can see they are building about the same amount of capacity right now and in the future. So Indonesia by far dominates the nickel supply. About 3 million tons today, projected to, you know, double within next 15, 20 years. So when we talk about the creation care approach to this, there are two main methods that nickel ores are processed by. The pyrometallurgy, which means high temperature processing, big furnaces, electric furnaces, temperature at or above the melting point of processed metals, quite high emissions from such processes. Then hydrometallurgy, which is acids, leaching, is really the dominant approach that people are pursuing right now. And most of these Indonesian operations are practicing hydrometallurgy approach with quite significant environmental consequences. No one talks about vapometallurgy. That's sort of the point I want to make here. It's a little known, considered niche. It's not that it's completely unknown. There is about half a dozen companies around the world that are practicing this. Only about 100,000 tons of nickel is produced by vapometallurgy. So keep it in perspective, out of 3 million, 100,000 is by vapometallurgy. And my message here is, or what we are trying to do at the University of Waterloo, is to rediscover this method and describe its merits and motivate, you know, companies to consider it. That's an example, last year conference of metallurgists. So this is the professional meeting of metallurgists globally. And when you look at, indicate what field best describes your interest, no, vapometallurgy is not even mentioned. That's a blow up of this section. So I was looking for vapometallurgy, nowhere to be found. You see hydro is there, light metals, pyro is there, other topics, but no mention of vapometallurgy. So again, just to say what are the main criteria in my view, impact on environment. Most of these are sort of obvious, but I think it's worth restating them. The end use of the mine products, in this case nickel, is extremely versatile. The working conditions or worker safety in operations would be another criterion. Community acceptance, it's also a sort of a no-brainer. This is what the SO2 emissions, so remember sulfide ores underground. This is Sudbury, Northern Ontario. That's the superstack, which is being dismantled right now. But that's 1960 here. Today is at the end. At that time, the operation was spewing out 2,500 kilotons of SO2 per year. And you can see by focused effort on that aspect of the operation what is possible. So over the period of 60 years, we are down to less than 1% of this initial number now. This is what the Sudbury landscape looked like in 1981. That's 2008, and that's roughly today. So it's back to normal. So it can be done. So this is another... I won't spend too much time on this, just to show that there is a significant gap of processing capacity missing. With all this nickel for batteries, we will need something like 3.5 million tons by 2040. And the question is, where will this come from? Will people continue building hydrometallurgy plant with acids and, you know, devastating the environment? Or will they consider the technology which is currently operating in Sudbury? This is a aerial view. Aerial view of the Sudbury carbon refinery. It produces about 70,000 tons of class 1, meaning high purity nickel, every year. This is the only other place in Canada that runs this process. It's much more specialized operation, but the same process in principle, about 450 tons per year. There is no one else doing this in North America currently. There is one company not that far from here in Oklahoma, called West Twin Elements, that just became convinced that this is a worthy approach, and they have a pilot plant running in Lawton, Oklahoma, as of a few months ago. So this is a brand new initiative. 20 tons per year, but they are hoping to build a real refinery at that location down the road. I probably don't have time to go through this in any detail, but the principle of vapor metallurgy is quite simple. It's this magic reaction of carbon monoxide and nickel or iron that happens at almost room temperature, 50 to 80 degrees C. It's fully reversible, so you can make this compound nickel tetracarbonyl or iron pentacarbonyl just by reacting carbon monoxide with finely divided nickel or anything that contains nickel. Very selectively, CO will pick up nickel and iron, if there is iron, and make these carbonyls. Then once you have these carbonyls, which in case of nickel carbonyl, at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, it looks like water. If I had a jar of nickel carbonyl, it would look just like water. It's a transparent, clear liquid. Boiling point is 43 degrees C. And if you continue heating carbonyl at about 200 degrees, the reaction becomes reversible. So it's a convenient way of picking up nickel from different mixtures, making carbonyl, then decomposing carbonyl in another vessel to make high purity nickel powder or nickel deposits. The same thing applies to iron. The downside is the toxicity of this compound. The TLV in the US is 1 part per billion. In Canada, it's 50 parts per billion. Don't ask me why. But as I mentioned, about 120,000 tons is produced today. Why do we say that this should be revisited? So in terms of environmental impact, this is an aerial view of the refinery in Wales, in a place called Clydach, just north of Swansea, that was started in 1902 by Ludwig Mond, the discoverer of this compound. It's running today, 2025. Producing 40,000 tons of high purity nickel every year, with no nickel ores or no nickel supply anywhere in sight in the UK or anywhere in Europe, actually, for the matter. All the feed is brought either from Canada or from Indonesia. And that's what the refinery looks like. That's right here. You can see the village is right next to it. Like, literally, there is a fence and houses behind the fence. So when people ask about environmental impact of this process, I usually show them this picture. That's the environmental impact. You can be this close to inhabited areas. There are no emissions from the process. That's just another view of that. There is the village, and that's the refinery boundary, and that's the process. I had the privilege to work there 15, 20 years ago, periodically. It's a very interesting place to work and visit. So just to finish off, the other source of nickel, for example, or metals are mining residues or waste piles. This is an example of 6 million tons of spent residue in my home country of Slovakia. It's actually from Albanian ore. For 30 years during communism, they were importing this ore, extracting the nickel, 80% of it, and leaving everything on the side. So over the 30 years, there is 6 million tons of very fine polymetallic residue. It's about 50% iron. So there is still about 0.2% nickel. So about 10,000 tons of nickel in that pile. And interestingly enough, the laterite ores contain scandium. Scandium became quite valuable recently. It costs about $4,000 per kilogram. It's used in aluminum alloys. So there is something like $15 billion worth of metals, if you imagine those metals being refined in their final, you know, product form. So one challenge and one project we are trying to promote is to actually build a small refinery right next to this place and gradually start processing this. This is just an example. Last time I was there, I brought my 3D printed Abraham Lincolns with me, and that's my rental car, and that's the pile behind. So the idea is to convert this pile into something useful. If you want to look at those later, you can bring them here. So this is just one picture of the lab in Waterloo, where we are slowly trying to sort of reinvent the wheel in a way. We have a small system that can produce carbonyl products. And that's my colleague Vahid, who is actually in Slovakia right now trying to prepare ground for some work there. And finally, this is the picture from the Oklahoma company. In God We Trust. I like that. It was actually founded by this young girl. I think she's 30 years old now. And somehow she became convinced that this is a worthy method of processing nickel, and has actually several hundred million dollars of funding behind her right now. And she's working on that. So recap, the criteria I'm proposing are really quite obvious. Impact on environment. If we have a process which is really so friendly to environment, why not consider that? Even today, the end use of nickel is quite indisputable. Every stainless steel item would not look like that, would not be stainless if it didn't contain nickel. Working conditions, community acceptance, batteries. I didn't talk too much about that, but there is more nickel in lithium-ion batteries than lithium itself by weight. And so the 130-year history of nickel vapor energy development led to the current small number of refineries in Canada, UK, there is one in Russia, two in China, producing this much nickel. While utilizing highly toxic process intermediates, the carbonyl process has high attractiveness from environmental impact perspective and potential for development of new products for battery applications. Thank you.
Questions?
Yep.
Wow, great talk. How does the cost compare between the two methods of
producing? Yes, that's quite often used as one argument for people not taking it too seriously. The cost of the actual refinery is high. Depending on who you listen to, it's actually not that much higher than a new hydrometallurgy plant, but it is high. My response to that is that the refinery in Sudbury, for example, was turned on in 1973. So we just celebrated 50th anniversary 2 years ago. When you walk in there and you compare it with the pictures from 50 years ago, no change. So it's basically a big pipeline. It's lots of pipes inside. So depending on what you put in your spreadsheet for the amortization period, you will get either a high number if you make it 10 years, or if you make it 50 years, you will get something much more acceptable.
Yeah. Is the maintenance cost more?
No, not maintenance. It's mainly the capital to build the thing and to not be scared of the toxicity of the intermediates. I think that's the other big issue.
What was the driver for the small new plant you want? Was it military related?
That's a good question.
I mean, it's the home of the field artillery. Is there a tie to the military?
There are definitely many military applications of high purity nickel. I don't think there was a very direct military involvement at the beginning. I think they are talking to the US military now. But it was to a large degree a skill of a small company from Canada that has been practicing this technology for several decades that convinced a group in Oklahoma to consider this.
The price of shipping more to and from?
That's a big issue, but it's really a problem everywhere because in the US the nickel resource is very limited. And the Welsh installation is a good example that even though you don't have a source of ore anywhere nearby, they've been running for 120 years now, right? So, yeah.
Okay. Just last question.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm glad that the nickel in sulfides, when it's processed out of the mines and refined, as you showed from the nickel and the super stack there, you can get a lot of sulfur dioxides and stuff.
Right.
In the laterites, are they aren't sulfides? Are they more oxides?
They're all oxides, yes.
Yeah, so is also the processing of that also environmentally better than processing the sulfides? So is this kind of a double win, or are there other factors?
Well, it would be a double win if the people processing laterites considered this process, which they could, because Inco showed many years ago that it works on laterites. But currently they are all approaching this with the hydromet approach, acids, and therefore there is an environmental issue with that. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's thank Brad for this.